I thought my recording stopped and I was going to kill myself, but it's still going.
I mean, that would really be too much for me today.
Yeah. Welcome to Book It, hosted by Jill Birgit Ragasy. That's so dark. Jamie, don't add any of that. Welcome to Book It,
a bi-weekly podcast where we talk frankly about books. Book It is hosted by the Blue Manatee Literacy Project,
a nonprofit that operates an independent bookstore in Cincinnati, Ohio.
When you shop with Blue Manatee, you are giving back to the community. For every book purchased, BMLP donates a book to a child in need.
Book It is hosted by me, Michael Woodson.
And me, Jill Birgit Ragasy.
Because I have an inferiority complex, I kind of just assume that, like, you, me, and my dog are the only people that listen to this podcast.
Okay. So. I mean, what about the people in Istanbul, Michael?
And our amazing fans in Istanbul. But my brother-in-law was like, we've caught up on all of your episodes. We love your podcast. And I was like, whose podcast? Like mine? Like, aww, you're listening to it? So I just wanted to shout them out. Hey, Jess and Matt, thanks for listening.
So after our Instagram live on Friday, my sister called me and she said, Steven, her husband, is disappointed that he hasn't gotten a shout out because he subscribes to the podcast and he left us a review.
You're letting him down.
On whatever the Apple podcast thing is. And I was like, oh my gosh, that's so nice of him. And I have not mentioned him to date. So also, shout out to Steven.
We love you, Steven. Thanks for the review. Thanks for subscribing. We just love our fans.
Our families are wonderful.
They are, yes. Now they're fans. They're not just family. They're also fans.
That's right.
Yeah,
which is the dream. What are we talking about today?
So we've talked a little bit in recent past episodes, about the Hunger Games prequel, The Ballad of Songbirds and Snakes. Mm-hmm. You had finished it. I was continuously halfway through it. I have finally finished it, and I have some feels.
Okay, let's do it.
Some are good. Some are just okay. Yeah. None are, like, outwardly, like, bad. Some things just could have been better.
Yeah, I would say that's how I felt.
Yeah. So I'm going to start with, like, specifically things that bothered me. Mm-hmm. And since we were, like, mostly spoiler-free last time, I think it's going to be a little bit spoilery this time.
Yes.
Like, if you haven't read it, there will be a little bit more spoils?
Spoils. There'll be lots of spoils. This time. It's the spoils of war. Michael's got a crate full of gold.
So before, we've mentioned pacing with The Ballad of Songbirds and Snakes and Hunger Games in general. Suzanne Collins, the author, is killer at pacing when it comes to action, no doubt. Mm-hmm. I think there are very few authors who know how to do a cliffhanger quite like she does. She's so good at ending her chapters.
That entire scene where I've forgotten the character's name, she's on a beam and the other three are coordinating the attack against her and one of them has like a trident.
Yes. Oh, yeah, like, yeah, yeah.
That whole section, so good on pacing. Really, yes. Like, you're in it. You see all the characters. You feel it.
Yes. And, like, that that's just sense of anxiety and urgency as a reader is there. It's palpable. Mm-hmm. However, with character-driven pacing, kind of doesn't exist.
Yes.
I'm thinking specifically, there's a character in the book called, would you say, Sejanus?
I do not know how. I'm so bad at the Hunger Games names. I feel like you need more Latin knowledge than I have.
So whatever his name, his name is Sejanus for this episode. Just for a little bit of background, he lives in the capital, and the book takes place during the 10th Hunger Games, so after the war, but the Hunger Games are still relatively new. He lives in the capital, but he comes there by way of District 2 with his family, and he still feels very much District 2. He does not feel like he belongs in the capital. And the capital kind of resents the family because they, like, got there by money. His dad is just, like a billionaire and just, like, pays his way through everything. It's apparent from the beginning that he's, like, very anti-games, and he, for lack of a better word, wants to, like, overthrow the capital with any remaining rebels that are out there. Okay, fine. I'm down with that. I don't mind that character. Like, he's needed. And the pacing there is, it's not terrible, but it's kind of forgettable. You know what I mean? It's not bad. But his demise, the tying up of his story is so rushed that any emotional weight that was wanted was completely erased. There's so much setup for it. And it, like, lots and lots of exposition. The book is very expositional. It's very exposition heavy, but very little on payoff. And his character, I think, deserved maybe a little bit more time on his end.
Yes, I feel like he went from deeply empathizing with Marcus, and when he sneaks into the stadium and you're like really feeling that, and Snow manages to kind of coax him out, and it's again a harrowing, climatic, really well done scene there, and he's feeling kind of, you're feeling the sadness and the overwhelming of it, and I feel like he comes out of that and realizes that he nearly sacrificed the person he says is his only friend.
His brother. They say they're like brothers.
Brothers, yes. So you're like, okay, that's where he is. And then, like, 5 pages later, in which he's not mentioned and maybe a week goes by, he's like a radicalized spy within the security force who has deep connections with the resistance and is orchestrating a mass breakout from a security detention center.
And I think that she thinks she can do that because she got away with it in the original trilogy in a way that was, like, totally plausible. Like, the perspective was first person, Katniss, present tense. So there were things that she didn't know that were going on while she was in the games. I'm thinking Catching Fire specifically. So when she gets out and we learn that Plutarch is, like, part of the resistance, we believe that because it's been happening off stage.
Yes.
That but doesn't
when
land.
When your book takes place off stage.
Right. That's a really good point.
You have to do the
work. Do the work, Susie.
Show your work.
And his character isn't the only one either. Like,
no.
Lucy Gray's story is kind of the same, and it harkens back to, I think, to a lot of issues people had with Mockingjay from the original trilogy.
Yeah.
I recently reread the Hunger Games trilogy within the last couple of years, and getting to Mockingjay, all I could remember was everyone's frustrations with it, but I couldn't really remember why people were frustrated with it. And in reading it, I thought the first half was amazing. I was just like, this is clearly the best book in the trilogy. It's so good. It's so interesting. And then the second half was just, like, wild, like, so fast, too fast. Like, the pacing was so unreal that any emotional weight or, like, response that Suzanne Collins wanted from me was lost because it was happening way too quickly. And that, I think, is true with Lucy Gray as well, because she's so, I'm so interested in her, but I'm not given enough of her to, like, know if that's even fair, because
she's so one-dimensional. She's like,
I think, accidentally
manic pixie dream girl in the worst way.
I think that was the game she was playing, but we didn't get the, but the end was so quick that it doesn't that's not fair, because, like, if that's true, I need more time to know, like, she's just been fucking with them the whole time. But, like, her, I don't want to give anything away too much because I want people to read this, but, like, how her story ends is so convoluted, and, like, her storyline ends is so convoluted and hard to track. But in reading it, I was like, okay, so I guess she's just been, like, playing them the whole time. I guess she's been playing Snow the whole time. Like, but, like, there's no time given to it, and no, like, there's no point where I could go back and be like, oh, that's what she meant here. There was not enough planting ahead of time.
I think we're supposed to wonder that, but I don't really.
I do. I mean, I really do, but I don't think in the way that she wants me to wonder about it. Like, I'm wondering if she, I just wanted her to do more, because I do think that that was her intention. Obviously, speculation. Who knows? It could be truly that this was just a poorly written, poorly developed character. But she's more clever than that. She's shown us that she's more clever than that. So I just think that, like, she spent so much time in exposition, unnecessary exposition where it should have been much more character driven for them too, specifically.
Yeah, we talked about this on the last episode. The vast majority, I don't wonder about their relationship. It's not possible that there was anything there. I didn't believe it from the start. Whether or not she was playing him, I don't really care because I found the whole thing so unbelievable.
Okay, I'm really glad you bring this up. You mentioned that you don't think he was really in love with Lucia Gray, and I totally agree that he probably wasn't, and that she definitely wasn't in love with him or trusted him. But I really do believe that he thought he was in love with her, and this is why. He has no idea what that means. So, of course, this, like, feeling that he's having, like, oh, we're so in love, we're soulmates, because he's, like, an emotionally stunted, selfish 18-year-old who lives in the capital, who grew up in the midst of war, and thinks this experience is the feeling of love. I totally believe that he believes that. And at no point did I feel like Suzanne Collins was trying to convince me that they were in love. I felt like she was showing me that they weren't, but he doesn't know that. And what makes that clear to me is how he oscillates between, like, infatuation and jealousy and confusion and love, or, like, so, like, meant to be, and, like, doing these things that he doesn't want to do, and then, like, ultimately sticking to this horrible person that he is. Like, I think fully we are not supposed to think that they're in love, but I'm supposed to think that he thinks he is.
I hear you.
Do you? Because I'm screaming.
I just don't agree. He so much equates their relationship with the love he has for his mother. And
that also was, like, out of left field.
Well, I mean, he's really conjured in his mind a relationship with his parents. Clearly, yeah. He was closer with his mother, and sure, she was taken away from him at a very young age. But mm-hmm. I do think he very much equates the two. And so I don't know.
Cool.
I just didn't find it believable. And I think he spends so much time being like, well, I don't know. Now that I've walked myself into this, I'm going to backtrack. He is a person who doesn't think deeply about things. Like, when it finally occurs to him that he should think maybe about how his cousin gets money when they need it, is
right,
a source of great annoyance to me. And again, you know, I'm like, I mean, get real. They're super close. They're besties. They're like two people facing the harsh world. And he has no idea. He chooses not to think about it.
Exactly.
And so I guess from that perspective, you could say maybe he thought he was in love with her and chose not to look at it very deeply. But the whole thing just feels like an easy excuse for bad writing.
Either way, I didn't love that that was part of the story. Like, whether or not, as the reader, we were supposed to believe that they were in love or not, I didn't want that to be it anyway, because she was already at a disadvantage, because Snow is way less of an interesting character than Katniss is. Mm-hmm. So I was like, I was disappointed when I found out that it was revolved around Snow. But there was a part in it when she, and I think I mentioned this before, but Lucy Gray is doing an interview before the games, and she decides to sing and wins over the crowd. And Snow's response is that he is so jealous. And then you turn the page. And I was like, yes, okay. So, like, Snow's a terrible person. He's jealous that she has the limelight. But then it was, oh no, he was jealous that this was a song about a boy that isn't him. And I was like, God, no, like, The Hunger Games is so much more interesting than that. Like, he is such a terrible person and a terrible character that I would have fully believed that his jealousy was coming from the fact that there was attention being taken off of his excellence.
I guess that's part of why I think we were supposed to think they were really in love.
Hmm.
Is that, you know, it wasn't just that it was always about ambition or always about, I think we were supposed to think they were in love.
Okay.
But
cool.
But I didn't. I think you've raised interesting points, though. I definitely I don't know at this point if I enjoyed the book more now that we've talked about it. I might reread part of it with that frame of mind. I don't know. It just wasn't good enough for.
Yeah. Well, and I did want to mention. Okay, so I want to go into things that like really didn't bother me.
Yeah. Tell me.
You had mentioned that you had wanted more of an expansion on like how we got here, like how this world was created, what the war really was, like how can the Capitol even remotely get away with this? Mm-hmm. And I have to say, like, I fully don't care about that when I'm reading it. I think because, like, to your point, actually, last time, it's maybe irrelevant. Like, Suzanne Collins has said in writing The Hunger Games, she got the idea when she was channel surfing one night and she was flipping between like Kids Jeopardy and footage of the Iraq War. So I think for her always, and for me as a reader, The Hunger Games exists as kind of like a moral story and a dilemma. And in a way that sort of asks us to like, what is stopping us from being inhumane to each other? Because I think in reality, like you could ask that same question about ourselves right now. Like, how did we get to where we are today? Does that matter? Because like, are we treating each other so poorly?
Yeah, no, I definitely think that's the question she wants us to ask. That is one of the questions posed by Dr. Gull, literally in the book.
Oh, yeah.
And that's my like my whole thing where I'm like, I get it. I know what you want me to think about. You have said it. You've alluded to it 9,000 ways. And now you've explicitly said it to me.
I also, that didn't bother me either. Like that it was like more heavy-handed because I also said like, or I didn't really feel like it was particularly more heavy-handed than some other YA I've read.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, I do relate it to Mockingjay in my feelings. Like, the first two halves weren't terrible. The third half was kind of a mess. And those first two halves, I really liked how... I was surprised by how different the games were. I was surprised by, really, how awful they treated the districts. Because, like, the tributes. Because... Mm-hmm. In The Hunger Games, they're, like, treated like celebrities in the Capitol, but in Ballad of Songbird and Snakes, they're literally caged in a zoo and, like, treated poorly, and, like, a lot of them die before the games even start from, like, malnutrition. Mm-hmm. I don't know why. I just didn't expect that.
I didn't either. I thought that was interesting. And the point at which, you know, she wins and you think the story is headed in one direction, and you basically, it's like the last sentence in that section of the book, and it's like, and you're going to go be in the security force. I mean, like, I literally gasped. I was like, wait, what? And then what is the last third of this book going to be about? And like, I needed to know immediately. It did that so well.
She does that well.
Yeah. I mean, it was a cliffhanger. It was, you know, a left field turn, but it worked really well and she executed it flawlessly. I did not see it coming and it made so much sense. It was just everything that came after it that ruined it for me, really.
Yeah, it was just a bummer of an ending. And I will say, like, I had texted Jill, I was like, I'm on part three. And Jill was like, I have to say it's the worst part. And I was like, cool, can't wait.
This
will be awful. And it was just hard to get through.
Yeah. Yeah, I kind of just read the third part all the way through, but mostly because I had already decided I wanted it to be part of what we talked about in the last episode. It was what I wanted to talk about. So I was like, I'm going to plunge through because I had so many feelings about expectations versus reality.
It's a great book for that subject. And I think it did do something that I think is successful for me when a prequel is successful, which is it made me like anxious reading it, that I knew that in this world for the next 70 plus years, there are the Hunger Games, there is torture. And like say what you will about the Star Wars prequel trilogies, but like every time I get to the third one, I'm always just like, please just like don't break Natalie Portman's heart this time. Like, be good for once. Like, this time I watch it, don't turn into Darth Vader. And so then I'm like, okay, I guess like it does make me anxious for the thing not to happen, which I think is ultimately what a prequel is supposed to do. Because like prequels usually end at the start of something bad. Do you know what I mean?
Yes.
So I think I'm trying to
recover from your example because I so hate that moment in Star Wars. I mean, let me get this straight. We're at some point where we have intergalactic space travel with aliens and women are still dying in childbirth. And from what? Sadness?
But it's a long time ago. It's not futuristic.
Okay.
It's a long time ago in a galaxy far, far away.
I feel like if you can interact with beings on other planets and travel intergalactically,
at light speed,
you don't die of sadness in childbirth.
Clearly, you've never been gay. I die of sadness every day.
I can't argue with that.
So I am glad I read it. And I do think, you know, we, something that kind of is a bummer about the quarantine a long list of bummers about the quarantine is that, you know, this book came out late spring, something that we love about having a retail space and getting to get out into the community is talking about upcoming books, mm-hmm. getting people excited for upcoming titles. And it's just been a lot harder to do that without a space, without that like person-to-person interaction, even with me and you. I mean, like you every day in the retail space would be like, have you heard about this book? You need to read it. And I'd be like, oh my gosh, I will. And we've just had less opportunity to do that. Mm-hmm. So what are we doing today?
Today, we are going to talk about books that came out in quarantine that we loved, which was convenient because I feel like I haven't been able to read as much during quarantine. So I was glad we're talking about current releases than future. But I thought we could talk about some books that are coming out over the summer and what we thought about them.
Yeah, so like Ballad kicks that off.
Yes.
Let's talk, what are some books that you have read recently that you've been really excited about?
So I'm going to start with my favorite right off the top. And it is Seven Clues to Home. And it came out in June. We're recording this in like, I don't know, the middle of June. And our copies just arrived at the store yesterday. I was really glad to see them. I took this book on our Christmas vacation and Pippa and I both read it and both gave it thumbs up. It is set in current times. It's realistic fiction. And in the present, Joy, it's her 13th birthday. And we find out really early on she lost her best friend, Lucas, in an accident the year prior on her birthday. And she wonders, you know, they had this tradition of doing a scavenger hunt on her birthday that he created for her every year. And she wonders if she should finally open the envelope that's the first clue to last year's scavenger hunt that he left the night before he died. And as she works through the clues, you know, she's working through her grief. And she shares the memories of her friendship and kind of the depth of their relationship. And then it alternates chapters with Lucas in the past setting up the scavenger hunt on the day before he died. So what I love about this book is that it involves grief, but it isn't about grief, if that makes sense.
Mm. Yes.
It celebrates friendship and it delves into family dynamics. And it's a little bit of a light adventure story. It's a lot of things. And interwoven into the narrative is this complex storytelling from two points of view. And it's actually written by two writers, Gay Pollenzer and Nora Raleigh Baskin. And it's really well paced and it keeps you really engaged. And each time I'm like, finished a chapter, I was ready. Like, what's the next clue? What's Lucas doing now? Is Joy going to figure it out? There's so much to love here. And Kirkus gave it a good review and they seem to hate everything. So
Kirkus notoriously just like hates the work that they do.
Yes. I don't know. They hate all books. They gave this one a really great, they said something like poignant and triumphant. And I was like, whoa.
Oh my gosh.
Right? Wow. Okay. That gives you some perspective. I would say it's best for like ages 9 to 13.
Okay.
The cover is cute, which I think helps sell a book. But it's just, I don't know, I really enjoyed it. It was one of my favorite things that I read on my vacation, but I don't think the vacation is why I liked it.
Grief books for that age group are usually, like, when they're done well, they're some of the best. And I'm thinking, did you read the book, The Thing About Jellyfish, when that came out a couple years ago?
Yes.
What you're saying sounds very similar.
Yeah, I think if you liked this book, you would like, if you liked the jellyfish book, you would like this one, and vice versa. It's very much in that tone. This one's a little lighter and more, because it's got the kind of irreverent going on, sure, a scavenger hunt sort.
Wasn't
of
there a book,
feel to
what's it,
it
called? Counting to Sevens?
Yes. Yes. I loved that book too. Yes. I feel like you've put your thumb on what I love. No. You get it.
Well, they're just, you know, if you liked these, you'll love those.
Yes.
And, or vice versa. Yeah. I think there's something about that, because, like, we've talked a lot about hard topics in books with authors on this podcast. Mm-hmm. And grief is one of the ones I actually don't think we've talked about, really, because it's the grief, like, loss in a real, like, mm-hmm, this person has died way is a really hard thing to talk to kids about.
Yeah.
And there are some books that just do it so well. And I haven't read Counting to Seven, and I have read The Thing About Jellyfish. Now I cannot wait to read Seven Clues to Home.
Yeah, it's really good. Yeah. Yeah. What have you read that comes out recently?
So I just finished Clap When You Land by Elizabeth Acevedo.
Oh.
I was in the middle of reading this when we did our Instagram Live a couple of weeks ago. Mm-hmm. And it's a novel in verse, and it's about two girls who, one lives in the States and one lives in the Dominican Republic, and they are separated by distance, but they're brought together by a similar grief. I just realized we're reading very similar books here.
This episode is actually about grief.
This episode's about being gay and sad. That's my life. I don't know if this is a spoiler or not, because I didn't know this, and then I saw someone say it on Instagram. So in his summary of the book, so I guess it isn't a spoiler. So I'm just gonna say it. Sorry.
Spoiler alert.
So they have the same dad, and they don't know that each other exists.
Oh.
He spends half of his time in the States, and then half of his time in the Dominican Republic.
The dad does
have family in both places. So he has two daughters, and he dies in this plane crash. So they have this shared grief and don't know each other exists, kind of. And it is so gorgeous. It is, like I said, it's novel in verse. And Elizabeth Acevedo is known for that. She had a book a couple of years come out called The Poet X. Mm-hmm. Critically acclaimed, beloved. And I haven't read that yet. This is the second book by her that I've read. And what I think it does, what Angie Thomas does so well, which is it seems to really understand the voice of a young person and, like, kind of working through this, like, new reality, kind of grieving the loss of this person, but also grieving the relationship that didn't exist, grieving the relationship that will never exist. It's very adult. And that's what I really like about it, is that she doesn't talk down to the reader at all. She explores conversations that are difficult conversations, and, like, the mind of the young person is just really, really captured and just beautiful. It's just such beautiful writing. I highly recommend it.
I love how you seem so much more open to books that are in verse. It has really inspired me in my reading, because I used to hear that and just go, oh no, that's not for me. And
can I tell you something?
What?
Same. It's like a new development for me.
Yeah, I used to think I didn't like them. And then,
me too.
You know, we went Kent State, which was so good, and Brown Girl Dreaming. And I have this one, the one you're talking about now, on my to-be-read pile. And probably a year ago, I would have told you that, like, books in verse were not my jam.
Me too. This is what happened. I read Another Brooklyn by Jacqueline Woodson. I fell in love with it. I then decided to read Brown Girl Dreaming, like you said, because mm-hmm. it's probably her most famous work. Most recent famous work.
Yeah.
and it's written in verse. And it was the first novel in verse that I've read, I think. And I also was like, I loved Another Brooklyn. Don't know if I'm going to love this just because novel in verse isn't my thing. But I didn't know that. I hadn't read it before. It's like telling people when you're a kid, like, oh, I don't like olives. It's like, you've never eaten an olive, Michael. You don't know.
Yeah.
So I was reading it and I was just like, oh, this is, I get it. Like, I do get it. And listening to Jacqueline Wilson talk about it made a lot of sense to me because she said, I wrote it in verse because it's a memoir and it's about memory, and memory comes to you that way. It doesn't come to you in these beautiful, like, long sentences and thoughtful thoughts. They come to you kind of here and there.
Yeah.
And I thought that was so lovely the way she put that. So then I read Long Way Down by Jason Reynolds, also in verse, blew me away. Mm-hmm. Then we read Can't Say It Together, but I still, to what you're saying, I don't know. I don't know if novel and verse is for me. These two just happen to be two of my favorite books of all time. I don't think those two things can exist at the same time.
Well, and I picked up over the weekend Just Like Me, which is a picture book.
Oh, yeah.
And I recommended it on our Instagram stories on Monday. And I was like, well, I'm not sure. It's kind of long for a picture book and it's in verse. I don't know if I like books in verse. I mean, I need to stop saying it.
Again, same.
So well done, and it flows so nicely, like it, right. Having slightly more words on the page, I mean, yes, it's for an older audience than maybe like it's not for your 2-year-old, but it's mm-hmm. still great in picture book format. And when paired with the illustrations, I mean, the artist did such an amazing job in that book. Mm-hmm. And so you feel the pace of the verse in the art. The whole combination exactly. is beautiful.
Yes. And I think there's something about novel and verse that it's hard. I don't want to suggest that it's harder to do, but I think that you have to really know what you're trying to say. You have to really decide mm-hmm. what you're trying to say. You don't have the real estate to make sure that the reader knows what you're doing. You have like three lines, maybe four words to capture an emotion that you were trying to convey. And when it's done well, it's done really well.
Yeah, I agree.
So yeah, that one's out now, I believe. Yeah, we have it in the store. That one's out now. Mm-hmm. Just couldn't recommend it enough. What's another one from you?
Okay, so tell me, have we talked about Summer at Meadowood on the podcast already?
It's maybe about in passing?
About a girl who goes to summer camp?
Okay, I don't think so.
Hopefully we haven't talked about this. Well, we'll get to it. Okay, so the book is about a 13-year-old girl named Vic who reluctantly finds herself back at the summer camp she's attended for years after learning that her parents are having marriage difficulties that Vic plants squarely at the feet of her mother. And she was kind of looking forward to a laid-back summer at home with her best friend. And she's really furious that she's at camp and that her brother is sent to the boys' camp. And she feels like they were shipped off really as a matter of convenience for her mother. And slowly, through a combination of her relationship with her kind of crabby camp counselor and a really charming co-director of the camp, Earl, and his garden, she kind of finds her way through her struggles with her parents. And there's lots of things I love about this book. I'm a huge proponent of summer camp. Like a week or more at summer camp can be like a transformative experience in a child's life. And I love that this book shows how camp does that. And that that camp is a place where kids find themselves and they work through their stuff more independently or with the help of people who aren't their parents. Because sleepaway camp is one of the like really limited number of places that kids get to know people outside their family social circle in like a deep and meaningful way. And this book really lovingly portrays those relationships. And I loved it from that perspective because I don't know. I'm a camp pusher and this book just celebrates the coming of age and the personal growth that happens while you are fishing and canoeing and making s'mores.
Yeah, it does. Camp does offer uninterrupted self-discovery.
Yeah.
And I was so, I think it's, I love that we're talking about this because I was so hesitant to do camp. My parents desperately wanted me to, and I pushed back a lot. And so I never really did. I didn't go to sleepaway camp, but did a couple of like during the day camps, mm-hmm. went back home. If I spent more time to think about it, I think that it would be because I was afraid to self-discover mm-hmm. and reveal too much of myself too quickly at a young age.
Yeah.
Because I was, this is the eighth time I've mentioned it on this single episode. I'm gay. And but it's true, like when Josh went to sleepaway camp 1 year and he desperately wanted to and he loved it, yeah, and the camps that I did that were just during the day, I loved. I wish I had experienced as an adult. I don't have a lot of regrets, but I do wish I had done sleepaway camp.
I think it's one of the first places that you can go as a kid. It's almost like when you're in high school and you go to college, where, you know, you get to present, you get to rediscover yourself. You're presenting yourself yeah. to a whole new group of people. And not only that, but you're forming all of these relationships outside of the influence of your parents.
Yeah, you get to kind of remind yourself who you are.
Yeah. Yeah.
Which is lovely.
I love that. And I mean, I don't want to spoil it in the end, but it is, there is a lot of really nice reconciliation that happens. Hmm. It doesn't, everything doesn't tie up super neat in a bow, but it's got a nice ending. I would say this one is a little bit more mature. I'd say it's best for ages 10 to 13. And it was supposed to come out in May, but I think it got pushed to June. And it's by Amy Rebecca Tan. But I liked that one.
Good.
Okay, so I have to tell you, I think I might have talked to you about this book, but not on the podcast. The Nerviest Girl in the World.
Oh, you have talked to me about it.
I think I either talked to you or Aaron or both of you about it. So
I don't know much about it, though.
Okay, so this is about kind of a spunky preteen girl who goes from, I should say, this is set... And it's a historical fiction. It is set during the time of silent films. So she goes from being an ostrich rancher to a stunt performer in the moving pictures. And the movie director...
I'm shocked right now.
The movie director brings his film company to Lemon Springs, California, which is where she lives. And at first, he hires her brothers, who are cowboys, to act in the silent movies. And then he sees, kind of by accident, kind of the stunts that she can perform. And so she ends up being in the movies. And so there's lots of like really great information about like back matter, about the craft of silent filmmaking. And
wow.
The cameraman does at one point acknowledge like the theft of land from the indigenous people to the white settlers during the filming. And there's huge author notes about the real life person that the book was based off of. And I will say, again, Kirkus called this one plucky fun, and they hate everything.
They do hate everything.
I normally don't read a lot of historical fiction, so definitely keep that in mind when I say what I thought about it. I thought it was okay, but I didn't fall in love with it.
Oh.
I did like that it was different from most historical fiction. You know, you read a lot of things and there's like a weighty topic. We tend to have historical fiction that focuses on, you know, the impact of war or famine or oppression or, you know, like then there are always these big books.
Yeah.
This one is just meant to be fun. And I don't know, for some reason I kept waiting for the big thing. Maybe my expectations were wrong.
No, I actually think you say... You raise a point that Renee Watson actually raised with us in our interview with her, was that she has what you're saying about historical fiction being kind of weighty sometimes. Mm-hmm. And she had said, like, you know, I have a lot of YA books and just like books for older kids and teenagers that really do deal with a lot of heavy, important issues. But she wanted her newest book, Ways to Make Sunshine, just to be about a young Black girl getting to have fun.
That's right. We did talk about this.
And I love that. So I think that is kind of what you're saying here, too, is that, like, those things are important. And sure, those books need to exist. And this one also is about a moment in history, and it gets to be fun.
And it gets to be fun. I think if I had that mindset before I read it, I would have liked it more. I didn't dislike it. It just wasn't what I guess I was expecting more like social commentary, but totally. It's just a fun book. I read two historical fiction books this spring. The other one was Blue Skies, which we talked about, and that one I really, really loved. And this
I actually
one,
don't know if you've talked about it. You just put it on the stories.
Oh, that might be.
I'm dying to read it after what you said about it.
It was really, really good. And that one I picked up entirely because I thought the cover was cute.
So gorgeous, yeah.
I'm not a huge reader of historic fiction. I read both of those this summer. I enjoyed them both. I liked Blue Skies more. But
you and I are similar there. I don't read a lot of historical fiction either.
No, I usually don't.
Yeah.
This is a younger one. I would say ages like 8 to 10, 8 to 11. So, Michael, what else have you read?
So, a book that I read a couple of weeks ago, it doesn't come out until September. It's called Before the Ever After by the one and only Jacqueline Woodson.
That's right.
And I didn't mean to, but both of these books, the ones that I'm talking about today, are novels in verse. And this one is about a young boy named ZJ, and his dad is a professional football player. And ZJ, I think he's like maybe 11 or 12. He's pretty young. But this is in the late 90s, and his dad is experiencing what we will later in life, mm-hmm. in history, better understand, which is like the brain injury that comes with playing football. I don't remember what that's called right now, but it goes through his dad changing, like his dad's brain deteriorating and them having no answers and not understanding and him losing the version of the dad that he always knew. And we read it. The Jacqueline Woodson interview was happening, and then they announced that this book was coming out. So then we were like, oh my gosh, we would love to ask her about it. Would you mind sending us an early reader? Because, you know, we'd like to know what we're asking.
Yeah.
And I powered through it, and I was on the last couple of pages, and we've talked about this before, but Jacqueline Woodson writes so emotionally and with so much empathy that I get so choked up just reading her pages. And I was at the end, and my husband was on the couch with me doing work because we're both working from home a lot. And he had asked me something. He was in the middle of asking me something, and I like popped my head up, and I had just been crying, and I was just like, sorry, can you say that again? And then he started crying because I was crying. It is really, really powerful for a couple of reasons. It's a story about a boy and his relationship with his father. And his father is such a lovely guy and going through something so terrible. And Jacqueline Woodson does what I think is difficult to do, which is talks about an important topic without beating you over the head with it.
Mm-hmm.
And if you've listened to the Jacqueline Woodson interview podcast episode, she offered just a lot of perspective on why she wrote it in ways that, like, because when I heard about it, I was like, this is kind of strange for you, like a book about football, basically. But if you haven't listened to that episode, go back and listen to it, because she just gives us so much amazing insight. That Clap When You Land, which I talked about earlier, is an older audience. I'd say it's like YA going into adult. But I think Before the Ever After is a younger audience, but only, I think, because of the age of the characters. I think you can read, like we said, you can read Jacqueline Woodson at any age. She is really thoughtful with her word usage.
Yeah, I still have the files that they sent over. I have been hesitant to read this one. I have a family connection to a traumatic brain injury. And so I have been hesitant to wade into it, but I really want to. I feel like I need to be in the right headspace.
Oh, of course. I mean, yeah. I don't have really any associations with it, and it was hard for me, so I can't imagine.
Yeah. Yeah. I like that it was told from the kid's perspective.
Something else, too. We've talked about this a lot, but she, like, does such a good job legitimizing the child experience. Mm-hmm. So it's from the child's perspective. He's kind of losing this version of his father that he thought he knew. And then he's also has these three other, like, boys in his life that are his best friends, and they are really emotional and, like, there for him in ways that I think do a lot of work for young boys today, like, showing them you can, like, please love the boys in your life and, like, hug them when they need to be hugged and be a good friend in a way that, like, might scare you, but you can do it.
Yeah, that's interesting too, because we talked about that a little bit with Julianne McDonough, and you and I were coming up short on examples of boyhood friendship.
Yeah, I should have just waited for this one. No, I love that book.
I'm glad that's happening though. Like, that's
me too.
Yeah,
because I'm looking forward to reading that one. This is a digression, 100%. But when I was coming out, I had one really good guy friend who I was really nervous to tell. His name is Zach. I just want to give him a lot of credit because I love him so much. And it was the summer after my freshman year of college, and I was sitting in my childhood bedroom, and I had told, he was coming over just to hang out, and I had told him, like, I think he could tell that something was up. And I had come out to myself at that point, like, maybe 2 months earlier. And he was like, are you okay? And I was like, I don't know. I'm just kind of, like, confused right now. And he was like, he is also just, like, really poignant and lovely. He was like, are you confused about attraction? And I was like, yeah. And I'm also, like, by confused, I mean, I'm, like, super sure about it, but, like, I'm just, like, not stoked about it either. And his almost immediate response was, if you think it makes me think any lesser of you, it doesn't. I'm just, like, I think a lot of you, and I'm just, like, dying to tell people my best friend is gay and I love him. And I was like,
oh my gosh.
And it was like, I was so, Zach. I love Zach. Shout out Zach. He doesn't listen to this. Maybe he does. but, like,
is he our listener in Istanbul?
He was recently in Istanbul, and he just powered through these on the plane. I'm still afraid to tell straight guys that I'm gay just because I don't have a great history with straight people. But it just made me mourn the relationship I could have had with a lot of straight men if we had just allowed each other to, like, be friends all the way. Like, just be friends.
That's so interesting to me.
Yeah. Anyway, Before the Ever After, ages 8 through 13, I don't know how old, but it comes out in September. We will definitely be carrying it.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. Do you have any other ones?
I want to just briefly mention the book I am currently reading. I haven't even finished it. That's how much I like it. It's Dress Coded by Carrie Firestone, and it is about an eighth grader and her friends who leverage the power of social networking to fight their school's oppressive dress code. So super timely. I'm like halfway through it. It's so engaging. I really like that it accurately reflects teen life. Like, there was an active shooter drill at school, and they're all on their phones and social media all the time. And there's, like, teen angst. But then also it has a really nice portrayal of teen activism and deep empathy. And I'm not finished, but I am so in love with it already. I suspect it's going to be like a favorite Hansel for me.
Wow.
The book I have in my hand says it comes out in July. I think I don't know if that's still true. And I'd say this is like a tween book. So, like, maybe ages 11 to 15, because it's the characters are all in eighth grade. But it really nicely reflects, I think, how eighth graders act and behave. The cover is, like, really cute. And I just like it because it's a complex look at teenage girls in a way that doesn't minimize them.
Oh, such a good way to put it.
Yeah, I really, can I read you the back?
Please.
Molly Frost is fed up because Olivia was yelled at for wearing a tank top, because Liza got dress coded and Molly didn't, even though they were wearing the exact same outfit, because when Jessica was pulled over by the principal and missed a math quiz, her teacher gave her an F, because it's impossible to find shorts that are longer than her fingertips, because girls' bodies are not a distraction, because middle school is hard enough without all this. So wow. Molly starts a podcast where girls can tell their stories, and before long, her small rebellion swells into a revolution because these girls are standing up for what's right.
Let's get Molly on here.
Right? This book, I'm not even finished with it. It's so good.
And I love that you said that you're not finished with it because you love it so much. I love that. I love spending time in a book that I'm loving. I hate finishing a book too quickly because I'm just like, well, that was fun for a couple of days. Like, why did I speed that up?
It's definitely because of that and not because of the four children.
Well, but I did want to say too, if you're listening to this, you've heard a lot of like younger titles.
Yeah.
Sure. Jill has four young kids and she is our middle grade YA genius at Blue Manatee Literacy Project. That being said, if you're an adult listening to this, you can also read those books. I don't have children. I seek those out sometimes because they are just so good. If you hear a good thing about a young adult, a YA novel, a chapter book, read it. I don't know why you shouldn't. I learn so much about myself and about the world when I read generally, and that doesn't stop when I choose to read a chapter book or a middle grade book or a YA book.
Yeah, and I would say as the parent of a tween, I felt like this book appealed to me both from the lens of reading as, you know, I thought it would tween. I think it will be interesting to the tweens in our store. I'm going to give it to Pippa after I finish and get her take on it. But I also really appreciated the perspective on it as a parent, because you think, you know, and especially as a mom, you feel like because you lived it, you know what it feels like to have your body policed constantly by other people. But when you're so new to it and you don't have the life experience of it's been going on since you were 13 and now you're 40, it takes you back to that in a way that I know that when I was approaching it as an adult, I was not in the same place. But after this book has changed how I feel about it.
That is so interesting because I,
I'm not even done. I mean, I just feel like it says so much about it that I have such huge feelings about it and I'm not even finished.
Well, and that like we look without that perspective, we look back and think we knew enough or we did enough. And I think that when I was in high school and middle school, the school administration was absolutely policing girls' bodies and telling them this was inappropriate, that was inappropriate. And we were highly aware that it was unfair, but we didn't know what to do about it. We felt powerless. And in a lot of ways we were. And I think that books like this one, I think helps us reconcile those feelings, and it also helps young people find their voices and speak out for like what's unfair.
Yeah, I mean, I remember in our high school we were not allowed to wear like spaghetti strap tank tops, and I remember the reason being that it's distracting. And I just remember thinking like, that's kind of stupid. I mean, like, what about a tank top is distracting? And not really having the experience or the vocabulary or the knowledge to know that what I was really being told was my body was distracting because other people can't be in control of themselves. Our expectation is that I have to hide my body because a boy can't be in charge of his own feelings. But I didn't have that vocabulary. I didn't have that knowledge. And I love that we're looking at that now and being like, no, this is weird and wrong.
And this concept of like the underlying be ashamed of your body, then like it's distracting and you should be ashamed of that. And it's your fault. Yeah. It's like, but my body is your body is her body. Like, let's just like normalize the fact that like humans exist, like our bodies exist. And the more we pretend that, or the more that we perpetuate this idea that a girl's body is distracting to a boy, lets boys get away with things that are not girls' fault. So we need mm-hmm. to just like, just stop.
Yeah. I love that. It definitely goes into that. The other moment I really love in this book is that two girls who have very different body styles are wearing the same outfit and only one of them gets in trouble. And
wow.
Right? It's well done.
And I like the idea of like friends coming together. Like mm-hmm. it's an empowering like just message of doing the right thing.
Absolutely.
And that comes out when?
You know what? Let me Google it real quick. The spine says July 2020, but we've had so many delays.
Maybe our producer can put in a copyright-free Jeopardy-style music.
No, it looks like it's, yeah, July 7. So it looks like it's the expected.
Okay. Well, so then, like, as you're listening to this, be on the lookout on our Instagram for any of these titles, because this release is in August and many of these titles that we're talking about will be on sale. So just be sure to follow us all over social media on Instagram at Blue Manatee Books, Facebook at Blue Manatee Literacy Project and Bookstore, Twitter at Blue Manatee. We'll be shouting these out as well.
And don't Speaking forget... we have a brand new Book It email address. Hooray! And we're so excited because we're always saying, let us know like what you're interested in. Let us know what you're reading. And then there's like no follow-up as to what you would do with that information. Now there is. You can email us at bookit@bluemanatee.org.
Yeah. So if you have any books that you've been reading throughout the quarantine, the summer, books that you're looking forward to, that you think we should read, that you'd like to hear us talk about, on the podcast, please send us an email. If you have episode ideas, we love hearing about what you guys think. If you're book people, like, we want to talk about what you want to talk about. So shoot us an email again at bookit@bluemanatee.org. So yeah, that was fun. I really can't wait to read these books that you've talked about, Jill. And I can't wait to talk to our customers in our community about them.
Me too.
Until next time.
See ya.
Bye.
Thank you for listening to Book It, a bi-weekly podcast. If you're interested in learning more or donating to the Blue Manatee Literacy Project, you can find us online at bluemanatee.org. If you're in Cincinnati, come by and see us. We're located at 3094 Madison Road in Oakley.